Who are you?
My name is Bruno Hautenfaust. I was named for a saint who was a very wealthy man. Cut the vine, the women, the songs, the whole bit, and then inexplicably took a vow of poverty and became a hermit. Went off to live in the forest. In the nude.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love power. And it's time for Kill McCast. Yeah, it's time for Kill McCast.
Welcome to Kill McCast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome all the Val Pals out there listening to a new episode of KilmerCast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly riveting American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we're checking out Kilmer's role as a smooth criminal in 1997's The Saint. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is a writer and film critic, the editor-in-chief of MovieFreak.com, and a founding member of the Seattle Film Critics Society. It's Sarah Fetters. How are you doing today, Sarah?
I am doing terrific. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for being here. How is life out in the reliably cool and temperate Pacific Northwest right now?
Well, shockingly, it's actually cool and temperate today, which is a big change after our 117 degrees in downtown Seattle just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I can't imagine having to deal with that.
Well, and I mean, I know there are people out there that are used to 100 degree temperature. Trust me, we here in the Pacific Northwest, no, doesn't happen. Not even in August.
Yeah, when I heard about that, I felt so bad for you because it's just, I mean, to have to deal with, I mean, obviously climate change is real. People need to react, you know, accept that. And we are facing this challenge and it's just so difficult when your whole life you've lived one way and now everything is just thrown into chaos.
Right? No, there's some insanity going on there.
Yeah. Where are you right now on the spectrum between lockdown and post-pandemic bacchanalia?
You know, Washington State is pretty much all back open. Mm-hmm. You know, there isn't really a lockdown going on here. We're lucky in Washington State for the most part. You know, we're in the upper echelon of states that have vaccinated.
That's great.
And as far as Seattle's concerned, we're one of the top cities that has vaccinated.
That's awesome.
But I mean, there is definitely, you know, a split, that's sort of an east-west split in our state where this side of the state is like, vaccination, yay. And, you know, my hometown over on the other side of the state is kind of like, vaccination, meh. So that brings down our numbers somewhat, but you know, we're still, we're right around 70% for the entire state, which is pretty good. And hopefully we'll keep climbing because nobody wants to lock down again. And
not at all.
That's definitely a potential at the moment with everything going on with the Delta variant.
Absolutely. And now a Lambda variant, which is awesome. You know, having two of them out there is just the best idea.
Right. Ugh.
Have you personally reintegrated into what your life was like before the pandemic, or I mean, just before it started, I should say, because I think we still are in a pandemic.
Are
you going out to eat? Are you going to the movies? Are you doing those kind of things?
Well, I'm going to the movies because I don't really have much choice. you know, it's interesting because, so I actually went to my first movie with, you know, non-press screening, non-lockdown theater experience where, you know, the theaters technically are now fully open. They are, yes. You know, you can seat to 100%. And I went and watched Escape Room Tournament of Champions a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I have actually gone to a film that was not just press only, mm-hmm. or was not, you know, 20% capacity.
Mm.
And that was interesting. It was about a half full theater, so it wasn't so bad. And again, Seattle, we're kind of lucky in that a lot of people are, you know, fairly smart about all of this, but I would say it was like 50-50 between the people that were sitting in the audience that kept their mask on and 50% who didn't.
Mm.
And I, you know, I can't really, because technically you don't have to wear it anymore if you've been vaccinated. And it's not like I can go around and quiz people on, you know, you've been vaccinated, right? I mean, I'm not that kind of person, but
yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, I'm back doing stuff, you know, I'm at the gym when I can be, and, you know, a few times a week, and we just finished our softball season this year. And so, you know, I just got done playing softball, and now we're to the point where studios are mandating we go back to press screenings and not even offering screeners, which is
very true.
Horrible in my opinion, but
yes,
you know,
I would agree.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, they control it.
They do.
Yep. You mentioned sports. You talked about softball. So I was curious how you're feeling about the introduction of the Seattle Kraken now into the NHL since you're from Seattle.
You know, I think that's pretty great. It was really enjoyable to watch that whole thing happen the other day. I thought that they did a really nice job. I'm not a hockey fan. I've never really been a hockey fan, but I think so far they're as far as rolling out a team and making an identity for themselves and getting the community involved, I think they're doing a great job so far. I'm curious to see how it goes and what happens.
Yeah, I'm a huge hockey fan, and so I watched the Kraken take away Jordan Eberle from my team, the Islanders. So I was like, you got to take care of him because he's a good guy, and hopefully he does well for the Seattle Kraken. I love the name. The name's a great name.
It is a great name. I just hope that, you know, if we're gonna end up having to have clips of somebody saying release the Kraken, it's gonna be Laurence Olivier and not Liam Neeson. But yeah, that's probably not gonna be the case. But I'm hoping. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah, the licensing fees might be a problem.
Right? Well, it's Warner Brothers both ways. I mean, you're dealing with Warner, so you know, just go for the better movie.
Yeah, we'll put some ads for HBO Max around the arena. That'll cover it.
Jerry Bruckheimer is one of the owners. I mean, it's possible, right? I mean. Yep. I know he's more of a Paramount guy, but a Paramount and Disney guy, but you know, Warner's made movies with him. Come on.
He's got some power.
He does. He's got a little bit, just a little bit of power
just
there.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, since this is KilmerCast, we should probably talk about your own experience with the Kilmer canon. What would you consider your favorite Val Kilmer film?
You know, my favorite, I was thinking about this, and it is such a tough question because there's so many that I enjoy and I have a good time with. And there's so few that I think that are like just absolutely 100% great. That said, so I'm doing this series right now for the Seattle Gay News, and we've been doing it all year, and it's my 1001 great film series. And yeah, every
quite
month,
an effort.
Yeah, I mean, and every month I debut 100 films that are part of the series. It's been in alphabetical order, and I will say there is a Val Kilmer movie on the list, and it is one that most people will not expect.
Yeah.
It is Real Genius.
Oh, I love
Real Genius. Is absolutely one of my favorite films of all time. I think it is one of Val Kilmer's best performances ever.
Agreed.
And if you watch it, of all of those teen, college, high school, coming of age / sex comedies of the 80s, what Martha Coolidge does with that film, it hasn't dated nearly as badly as so many of the others have. And a lot of the observations that she's bringing up in that movie are just spot on.
Oh, yeah.
And Kilmer is brilliant.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so good.
So fully formed right out the gate in a second film, just bang. he's so great.
I completely agree. So that's probably my favorite. I do watch Top Secret and Top Gun on a regular basis. I'm not going to lie.
The top and top, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the top of the Kilmers.
Yep. I mean, I can't argue with Real Genius being a pick because in my office, it's the one Val Kilmer poster I have in my office framed right behind me. It's like, boom, I got to have my Real Genius. It established what I thought college was going to be for me when I was a kid.
Love it. Good for you.
So before we dive into today's film, we need to go back in time.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
So The Saint premiered in America on April 4th, 1997. I don't have a hard time finding a lot of things going on around the time of a film. It was an oddly quiet time. The only real news story I could find, well, I mean, a couple of them, but the biggest one was that Steve Irwin made his debut on TV as the Crocodile Hunter. So if like that's the biggest thing going on, pretty quiet time.
Yeah, I mean, if they could have just waited till July and then we could be talking about Princess Diana, but
there you go. It was a busy time in sports, however. Tiger Woods won his first majors title at the U.S. Masters, and obviously he went on to a successful career with no problems at all. Yeah, we're looking at this from the past, so who knows?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, of course.
The Hartford Whalers, again, back to hockey, they played their last game in the NHL before moving on down south to become the Carolina Hurricanes. And they've eventually won a Stanley Cup in Carolina, so that worked out for them. And Major League Baseball retired Jackie Robinson's number 42 across all of its teams, honoring his role in breaking through baseball's racist tradition. So good for him and good for baseball for recognizing that.
Yeah, it was about time.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, however, a very heavy, Clinton-heavy time in the news. And that, because this is the time of the Whitewater real estate investigation was going on under Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr. I don't think most people understood really what the Whitewater thing was, except for it was called Whitewater and the people kept bringing it up.
It was mostly baloney, except for this, yeah. The other stuff that came out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there was a ton of people involved in it that were a problem, but the Clintons never really were found guilty or even like close to being guilty of anything. At that same time, however, the courts ruled that the Clinton DOJ, I love this one, they couldn't punish California doctors for prescribing marijuana, which is such a quaint idea now. Because when you consider how we have legal marijuana in so many states now, and back then it was like, they wanted to punish doctors for giving it as medical. But you have, in Seattle, you have legal marijuana, right?
Oh yeah, it's legal just about, it's legal everywhere here.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have it at some point here in New York. Mm-hmm. It's not quite there yet. Like, you can have it, but you can't buy it. So it's a weird little limbo scene we're in now.
That is so strange to me that we legalized before you did.
I mean, New York has a lot of heavily conservative areas. That's the problem.
That's true. There you go.
We have Staten Island and we have a lot of Long Island, especially upstate New York. Very much a kind of like the extension of Appalachia in some of those areas. So it's not that surprising if you're from here, but I can, especially gotcha. See from outside, people being like, New York is like, come on. But it's absolutely true. We do have some that conservative leaning in some areas.
Okay.
And also at that time, Attorney General Janet Reno, she refused to have a special prosecutor investigate Clinton's reelection campaign financing, which, I'm personally a liberal and a Democrat, but I don't understand why we can't investigate our own. I mean, it's just, why not? Like, clean everything up. It's people have this like weird obsession with like defending Clinton, where it's like, no, if he did something wrong, you've got to bring it out in the open.
No, yeah, I agree with that. I also think that there were, it was the birth of all of the nefarious trolling and whatnot that we're seeing today. And it was probably the right decision to say no, but it didn't look good from an optics level.
No. Yeah, you definitely don't want to have somebody say we're covering for them. And that doesn't help.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump over to the Billboard and talk about music. So the number one song at the time of the film The Saint was Puff Daddy. He had the song Can't Nobody Hold Me Down. Do you know this song?
No, I do not. I thought I did, but nope, can't say I do.
Yeah, so this is his debut single.
Okay.
This is the first one that hit the charts for Puff Daddy, and I have to think it's pretty terrible.
I did not know this one. That's crazy. I would never have known. It's not the one that I would have come up with as his first hit.
Yeah, I mean, it's so monotone. There's hardly any rhythm to it. And like, he literally takes from like seven other songs and pushes them all together to make this song. You can hear samples and lines and stuff from all these other big songs. It's just not a song that I would put, if I was Puff Daddy, I wouldn't put on my best of, that's for sure. I mean, especially since he's gone on to do such better songs. Like,
sure.
I mean, I'm not the biggest Puff Daddy fan, but that is, that's terrible.
I hadn't heard it, so I'm not going to make a statement as to whether it's terrible or good. I had never heard that one before.
You're lucky.
But, there are ones that I do like, his going kind of insane, but whatever.
True. I like him for one reason. He's a fan of Chris Gethard. I don't know if you know Chris Gethard, the comedian, and he was on his cable access show, which is such an odd idea that this huge rapper would be on this comedian's cable access show.
Love that.
So number two, we have Wannabe by the Spice Girls. Now, I, without hesitation, will admit I was a huge Spice Girls fan. I had their first few albums. I thought they were so much fun. I even enjoyed their slower stuff, like To Become One and Mama. I mean, these were good songs.
I'm not going to lie. I love this song. I tried to tell people that I was above them and that I hated them at that time. It was another life. I was another person. There were things that we just couldn't talk about, and so I had to like not like them, but I adore them, and I probably know the lyrics to that song and many others.
I mean, it's funny because like this song is like crack. It's so just, it's just, I'm addicted to it when I hear, like, I always wanted to hear it.
It gives you what you want, what you really want.
What you really, really want. Yeah, it's funny. Whatever people think that BTS is, like that, they, since they're such a global phenomenon, Spice Girls was like 100 times that. You know, they were so massive everywhere. BTS is big, obviously.
Sure.
But Spice Girls was massive.
Well, and just imagine if they would have had social media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, God, if they had had that, they would be running for office.
They would have been, yes.
At number three, we had Jewel with Foolish Games. It's kind of a weird top three. It's very eclectic, though, between these three songs.
It is, but now I'm going to tear up. This song, the emotions.
It's gorgeous.
I just feel it, everything. I feel everything right now. I'm just dying.
I mean, her voice is amazing.
Yeah.
She doesn't get the credit she deserves for, you know, the talent she has. I think because she definitely got put in a box as a folksy singer.
Sure.
And it's funny because she could have been a huge pop superstar, in my opinion. I mean, do you remember the song Intuition?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was...
I may have had that on CD and listened to it over and over and over again.
Yeah, you listen to that, Foolish Games, and just this heart-wrenching, soulful song. And then Intuition, this very smart pop hit. And it's like, that's the same artist doing both of those things. And the idea that eventually she kind of like turned her back on all that and became country is such an odd thing to me.
Well, you know, sometimes when you're a musical artist, you got to do whatever you can to stay relevant. And let's be honest, country artists, they have a longevity that other genres just do not get.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are, in my opinion, they are the last resort for many people, though, because you see so many people who have mainstream pop success. And then when it's kind of petering out, then suddenly they go, oh, I'll just do country. Like, Darius Rucker and Steven Tyler. It's like, it seems like I don't know why it seems so easy to do it. You can just be like, well, I'll just put a little twang in it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's an easy way, especially as you get older and your fan base sort of ages out. It's an easy way to just get that jolt of popularity again and, you know, make yourself some cash.
Yeah, and worked for Jewel. She certainly kept herself in the spotlight for a long time.
She has.
Jumping over to TV, this being early April, obviously television was led by the NCAA men's basketball championship game, just massive numbers. However, it just barely edged out a rerun of Seinfeld.
Which is
incredible. I mean, that just shows how big Seinfeld was. A rerun of a sitcom almost beat the NCAA men's basketball championship game.
That is kind of insane.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider Seinfeld almost got canceled like 75 times.
This is very true, yes.
But yeah, that 1997, that was a painful year just because, you know, Arizona, which, don't get me wrong, they were the first team to defeat three number one seeds, I think, on their way to, you know, as a UW Husky, I was happy for the Pac-10 at that time, you know, Pac-12 now, but Pac-10 then. I mean, I was happy to see one of our teams win, but did it have to be that team?
Yeah. I
mean, the only thing that would have made it worse was if it would have been Oregon. So, I mean, Arizona, I can at least, you know,
yeah, they're further away.
I can give them thumbs up and say good job, but if it had been Oregon, then I would probably never be able to look, you know, in a mirror ever again.
Yeah, not quite the direct rival.
No ducks, please.
Yeah, in third spot on the ratings was a show I actually had to look up because I was like, "What is this?" And it's called The Naked Truth.
So I love that show.
You saw it, okay? So like, I thought when I looked at it, I was like, "Oh, this has got to be that Michael Moore documentary series that was on," but no, that was The Awful Truth. This is The Naked Truth, which was a sitcom starring Taya Leone. Mm-hmm. She was an employee at a tabloid newspaper. She was, I believe, a photographer.
Yep, Mahala Taylor.
And like, I honestly have no memory of the show. It just blanked out of my life. I guess I never watched it. But like, I watched the first couple episodes on YouTube in preparation for the show. Wow.
Yeah, right?
It is something else. Like,
yeah.
Really, you could say it's un-PC in a big way. Like,
I mean, it's almost 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, in the first minute of the show, the first punchline is, what a homo.
Oh, I know.
It's horrible. Wow.
I mean, it was progressive and horrible all at the same time. But I mean, what a great cast. I mean, Colin Taylor, Chris Elliott. I think Amy Ryan got her start there.
Yeah, Mary George Tyler Moore Siegel, was on it.
Tim Curry. Oh, you're right. Mary Tyler Moore had a couple episodes. I totally forgot about that.
In fact, in the first episode, Tom Hanks is in it.
Oh yeah, I think he produced it. If I'm not wrong,
he plays himself in a way that's so bizarre. It's hard to understand why he did it. Like, it really is just insane the way he acts as himself. I don't understand it at all.
I don't think anybody understands it. It's a great reminder of just how brilliant Tom Hanks can be when he's just, and how off the rails he is willing to go.
Oh, absolutely. That's what we love about him. I mean, he is the everyman.
I think it's what Taylor Leone did right after Bad Boys, if I'm not,
very possible. This was her second, at this point, it was the second season of the show. Eventually it would get canceled because, like most things that end up in the Friends, you know, zone in there, they last for a couple of seasons riding on the other shows and then disappear.
Yeah.
It's funny. They'll move it to another time slot and vanish. it's actually kind of crazy because it was the number three show, and also at the number six slot was a special about the Naked Truth.
What?
Yeah.
That's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even like it was a premiere because this is the second season. The other shows on the night, Seinfeld, ER, Friends, they were all reruns. And yet they like threw this Naked Truth and a Naked Truth special in there and still dominated because that's how NBC was at the time.
Yep, that is true. NBC had all the power.
Yep. I mean, ABC had one show in the top 10, and that was Home Improvement, and Fox had no shows in the top 10. So totally different time than what we see today, especially since there was no reality television on the air at that time, which was great.
Yeah, I mean, other than what, America's Funniest Home Videos?
Yeah, and even that wasn't doing well in the ratings, at least. Not like it was like reality television does now. If we jump over to the box office, The Saint opened in second place, earning $20 million, which placed it just behind the third week of the Jim Carrey juggernaut Liar Liar. That reached $105 million in total that week, which, I mean, Jim Carrey at that time was massive.
And that was one of his good ones, which helped.
Yeah, Liar Liar is a funny film.
It is. It is a massively underrated and somewhat forgotten film from his early phase, in my opinion. It's actually one of the good films.
Yeah, because he's not a total cartoon in that film. He's playing a character, at least.
Yeah.
Well, The Saint was well ahead of the second week of the Brad Pitt, Harrison Ford thriller, The Devil's Own. That was way behind at number three. Mm-hmm. And that was followed by two debuts. One of them was Double Team, which, I mean, your reaction tells me everything I need to know, because obviously that film stands out because it had a starring duo of Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dennis Rodman. So how can you go wrong?
Well, I mean, you can. You can go wrong. But, I mean, it is directed by, you know, Siwi Hark, which helps. Because the movie is unabashedly terrible.
Oh yeah.
But it's unabashedly terrible in a really fun,
it's going for it,
insane way. Thanks to its Hong Kong titan behind the camera.
The other debut that week was something I don't remember at all, and that's called That Old Feeling. Do you know That Old Feeling?
It's the Bette Midler, Dennis Farina movie.
Yeah, this is something that just missed me, I guess, at the time. Directed by Carl Reiner. Mm-hmm. And Bette Midler and Dennis Farina play a divorced couple who fall back in love at their daughter's wedding. Mm-hmm. Reviews were not kind. I must say that. But it's interesting.
Cruel.
No, but it wasn't one of the best. But what really stands out to me about it is it was written by Leslie Dixon. Now, Leslie Dixon is a screenwriter that I feel like she should be way better known. It's not somebody whose name most people know, but she wrote Outrageous Fortune, Blind Date, Overboard, Loverboy, Mrs. Doubtfire, The Thomas Crown Affair, and Hairspray. That is a career. I mean, how do we not know? How is Leslie Dixon's name not up there?
Like, a lot of that was uncredited. Let's be honest.
True.
And I mean...
But I mean, those are really solid, fun films.
I mean,
obviously you don't agree.
I do think her great films. I mean, if you look at Outrageous Fortune, to a certain extent if you look at Overboard, if you definitely look at Freaky Friday or the Thomas Crown Affair remake.
Yeah, I love the Thomas Crown Affair.
The Thomas Crown Affair remake is actually better than the original, which is saying something because the original has Steve McQueen and Dunaway, but the remake's actually better.
Mm-hmm.
Those are legitimately great films. And Mrs. Doubtfire is a phenomenon. It has amazing moments and has some incredibly well-written comedic bits. So hats off there.
Not a Blind Date fan, huh?
Blind Date, that is certainly not Blake Edwards at his best.
No.
And you know how much she actually contributed and how much Blake Edwards sort of did himself, you know, we probably will never really know for sure. I don't think that movie works. I think everybody in the film is in a different film. And I actually think Bruce Willis is miscast.
I do think it survives a lot on the charisma of the leads.
Yeah. But she's done a good job. She's got two Oscar nominations under her belt and, you know, and there's some good stuff in there. I just don't think she's outstanding. If anything, I think what's interesting with That Old Feeling is that it was sort of a misfire for Carl Reiner. That is more disappointing in some ways and more surprising in some ways, just because he's a legitimate comedic genius.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you look at his track record and his history, the fact that he couldn't quite get this to work with Midler and Farina, who are very good in the movie.
Okay.
They are really terrific. And yet the movie never gels. It never comes together. And, you know, and that to me is the more surprising thing, is that he couldn't get everybody to click together.
Mm.
And I don't know if it was a disconnect between, you know, it's like, could they, I don't know if they had just all never got on the same page or what, but
some that movies to me just,
is more surprising.
Some movies just don't work. I mean, it's just unfortunate.
Sure. It happens all the time.
It's true. So true. As any critic will tell you.
Oh yeah.
Well, the rest of the top 10 was Selena, followed by Jungle of the Jungle, the special edition of Return of the Jedi, then The Sixth Man, and finally the debut of Inventing the Abbott. So not really the most inspiring lineup in the theaters that week.
You know, I went to Return of the Jedi.
I think you have to.
I was there opening night at the Cinerama.
I mean, come on, you have to go if you're going to get a chance to see Return of the Jedi on the big screen.
It was hysterical. I remember, so that was so much fun, I will say, at the beginning of 1997. There was something strange in that, you know, when Star Wars was re-released, and the fact that we had to go stand in line at the Cinerama for 3 hours to go watch the first showing of a 20-year-old movie.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It was awesome and just bizarre. But it was glorious. I mean, you walk into the Cinerama and this massive, you know, 70-millimeter curved screen, and the crowd's going nuts and everybody's having a good time. And, you know, we were there opening day for Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, how many times do you get to go to the theater and everybody in the seats knows they're going to have a good time? Like, you hope you have a good time in most times when you go to see a movie, but everybody there knows they're going to have it. The energy must be like exhilarating.
It was. It was through the roof. It was just something else. I have not had a lot of experiences that I can say are similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
And living in Seattle, like, I mean, you living in New York, there are a lot of retro presentations. I mean, we do get stuff comes back here. We get to see it, which is great. But I honestly, it's hard for me to really equate anything that I've seen in the last 20, 25 years that's really equaled that.
Yeah.
And which was just strange. I mean, walking into a packed 800 seat audience for Star Wars, everybody is just psyched. I guess what would come close would be, it's the difference between a press screening and then going to the audience screening was, you know, like the press screening for Avengers Endgame was very different than when I watched it again a few nights later with an audience.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I don't really care about Avengers Endgame one way or the other. It doesn't really do anything for me. But I will say, as measuredly psyched as the press screening was, because I mean, there's always some press that kind of hoot and holler, but for the most part, it's a press screening.
Yeah.
People don't, they don't get excited for things. No. That audience a few nights later.
Oh, I can't imagine the explosion of it.
Oh my gosh. It made me almost want to go back home and, you know, resubmit a different review because you know, that energy is infectious. There is something about what an audience can bring to a film that cannot ever be underestimated or undervalued. And it's one of the things that I notice more now after coming out of this pandemic than I probably ever did before. And I'm one of the biggest champions of the theatrical experience. Mm-hmm. Trust me, you notice it now more than you ever did. And even just, you know, some like just going to a press screening of Cruella, of all things, with there's only six of us. I mean, there were six of us in the audience, just six of us. And you could hear everybody in the audience giggle and twitter and kind of make little noises throughout. And it has just because we were in a movie theater again.
Yeah.
As annoying as some elements of watching Escape Room the other day was, I mean, somebody turned on their cell phone and I wanted to throw popcorn at them. I mean, it's the worst. I hated it. But, you know, there are, it's a twisty, silly, fun movie that is supposed to get the audience involved. And when the audience got involved, I loved it. I'm not going to lie. I had more fun watching the audience react than I did probably watching the film.
I liked Escape Room. Cell phone
even.
Yeah, both escape rooms I think are really fun.
Yeah, I have a few issues with the second one, but I agree. I think if you like the first one, you're gonna like the second one. It's well done, it's entertaining.
Yeah, I'll watch a third yourself, one.
And I want to see, I mean, now that we pretty much have to have a third one now, so hopefully it makes just enough money that Sony makes a third one because we kind of need it.
It's probably gonna be a direct to video,
probably, which means that we
know Sony.
Okay, sorry, go on.
We are going to take a little break right now, okay. And then we'll be right back to talk about The Saint. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. So The Saint was written by Jonathan Hensley and Wesley Strick, and it's based obviously on the classic character created by novelist Leslie Charteris in the 1920s. So this character has been around for a long time. Hensley has a number of notable action films on his CV, including Die Hard with a Vengeance, Jumanji, and Armageddon. While Strick's resume is similarly impressive, he's got Arachnophobia, Cape Fear, and Final Analysis, among others. I mean, together they both bring a lot of what The Saint needed as far as being like an action kind of thriller film, I feel.
I love that you bring up Final Analysis for Wesley Strick and not like Wolf or, you know, The Man in the High Castle.
Not a fan. I'm sorry, not a fan.
And then you bring up, you know, you don't bring up The Rock for Jonathan Hensley? I mean, yeah, really? You're going to go with Armageddon?
I have some blind spots.
Okay, yeah.
But I think it's funny. They both have a little bit of like of their specialty that they bring to this film that really works together to make this film better than what, you know, it could have been otherwise.
It's interesting for me with this film in that, you know, we've been talking like, you know, we've just been chatting about how films age and, you know, trying to look at them through the historical lens and also looking through them through, you know, our current modern lens, and how those two things are not mutually exclusive. The Saint is interesting in that it has actually aged well, where at the time of its release, it's fairly obvious that, you know, the producers and Paramount were really trying to get another Mission Impossible.
Oh, yeah.
They had just had that massive hit with Tom Cruise and they were thinking, oh, you know, let's do this again.
Yeah, this is all about franchising.
And Philip Noyce is like, yeah, I don't think so. let's do something that's not really, I mean, yes, I've made you these Jack Ryan movies, but if you go back and look at them, they weren't really made as franchise films. They were made as individual self-contained thrillers. I do think that The Saint has some issues and I don't think it is as good as it could have been. But I am always surprised when I revisit it how much better it is than I have tricked myself into believing it was. And I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's because of it just, it wasn't as that successful at the time, or if it's just because I always notice little things on a rewatch where I'm like, oh, you know, that's actually kind of cool. Oh, you know, that's actually kind of neat too. And oh, this works pretty well. But I also notice the stuff that,
Yeah, I think a lot of it is that it has that unfortunate Kilmer influence where people, it came at a time when he was being noted for being a very difficult person to work with. And so the films instantly became negative experiences for people because, oh, well, he was being a jerk about it.
Well, and I mean, and there was apparently, you know, some tension between Noyce and Kilmer. And people also, you know, they like to point out the fact that this is the series that, this is the film that Kilmer decided to do instead of another Batman movie and all of that stuff. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, Noyce is the director, you know, Australian director. He was a lifelong fan of the Saint. He's been wanting to make this film forever. And as you mentioned, he gave us some real classics, including, as you said, Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. He also did Dead Calm. He's really kind of fallen off the map though recently. We don't really hear a whole lot from Philip Noyce. The last thing I noticed of his was in, I think, 2014, which was The Giver, which didn't do very well. So it's kind of like he kind of fell off.
Well, I mean, you know, he did, you know, he did have a hand in the recent Roots miniseries and he did,
he's done a lot of TV.
Yeah. And he did that movie Above Suspicion a couple of years ago with, my brain just stopped working with Amelia Clark and Jack Huston that unfortunately doesn't quite work, but it's very obviously a Philip Noyce movie and what it's trying to do. But you know, I'm still going to give him, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt always, if only because, you know, he did at least still give us Rabbit Proof Fence this century.
That's
true. So that helps me a lot. And you know,
that's a feather in the cap.
It's a total feather in the cap. And there's always the chance that we could at some point get a Salt sequel. So
maybe
they keep talking about it. And
I mean, that was, IP only exists to be remind.
Yeah. And I mean, everybody kind of seemed to like making it and, it was successful. I will say, it's interesting if you watch The Saint and then you watch Salt right afterwards, The Saint in some ways does feel like a test run for Salt, because a lot of the themes and a lot of the ideas and a lot of the actual misdirection and plot points are very similar. And you could easily see Angelina, I mean, obviously, you know, she's a spy and all that sort of stuff, but she plays a very similar character as far as somebody that is faceless, nameless, with no real history, who, you know, doesn't have an identity. That's very similar to the character that Kilmer is playing in The Saint.
Yeah, boy's getting to play out his saint dreams again.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the cold open to this film, which is insane. I mean, so basically, we
talk
get
about
to see
reinventing the backstory.
Yeah, we get to see the origin of the Saint in this cold open, as the Saint is a young boy in an orphanage, and he is in a fight with the headmasters, or whatever you want to call them, priests or fathers who are running the orphanage, because he, you know, he doesn't want to be who they want him to be. And so he ends up on the wrong side of them and basically leads like a revolution against the fathers, or the, whatever you want to call it, the jailers, you might call them, because they are basically kept in cages, right?
Basically, it kind of seemed like, I mean, you know, they were at least, it was more a prison than a school.
Yeah,
like.
Definitely. And so we get to the point where he's trying to break out the girls who are currently under lock and key. And these massive dogs are sent after him to stop him from getting them out. And when he goes in to save the girl and then goes for a kiss, the kiss is interrupted by the dog, and the dog sends the girl flying off a balcony to her death. And this is the introduction of this film. I couldn't believe it when I first saw it. I was like, that's how you start this story?
Yeah. It's certainly out there. I remember Roger Ebert kind of commented on that in his review about how the, you know, polar opposite tonal differences that are kind of happening throughout this movie and this sort of Dickensian opening that feels like it's in a completely different motion picture. It's interesting to me that this open, you know, the where we learn the backstory for our little orphan is so different than anything that appears in any of the, you know, any of the Saint novels or any of the previous motion pictures or the Roger Moore television series. It is a complete reinvention. And I wish that Noyce went into it more on his commentary track for the film.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of info on that track.
You do not. And I'd really love to know where the inspiration, whether it was the writers or it was Noyce himself who sort of came up with this idea, because it is so massively different than anything that this character has experienced or done in any previous incarnation.
Yeah, and my bigger problem is, if you remove this whole section from the film, does it have any effect on the film at all?
Other than giving you the insight into why our character uses the name of Saints as his aliases, it doesn't really give you anything. And then and why he decided, you know, to take on the, you know, the name of Templar, because he you know, viewed himself as a knight errant sort of going to rescue the fair maiden. But other than that, you know, it doesn't necessarily fit with everything we see afterwards, because his evolution into the character that people, that the few people at this time were familiar with from the Saint, as far as the Roger Moore incarnations or the George Sanders incarnations, you know, that's the thing you have to remember. This movie, he isn't that character until the end of the film, and we're watching him become that character.
Yeah, it's definitely an origin story.
Exactly. And he could have became that character the way that he does in the film, whether this opening was there or not.
Yeah, it feels like it's just like padding in the end, because it doesn't really, there are a few callbacks to it, but not that have any real effect on the story or the plot of the characters for the most part.
I think you could have come up with another way for him to say why he uses the names that he does.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and that's really the only reason that it's there. No. And it's also, obviously, it's there to sort of show why he doesn't want to get a close connection to anybody.
Mm.
But again, I don't necessarily know if you needed to do it in this manner. It just doesn't necessarily work that well to me.
No. And so we should talk then a bit about the plot of the film, because, you know, since that's separate from this, essentially, this story, it's definitely one of those Soviet power films, like from the 80s, a little updated, because
sure,
you don't have the usual G.I. Joe hero at the center of this. You know, there's no Mr. USA, there's no, you know, there's no Cold War per se about this, because this is a post Soviet idea where this government is trying to gain control over a massive power source, and a spy or a thief is trying to stop him because just purely for money. So but like at any point in this film, I didn't care about this plot for the most part. It didn't feel like it was a really intrinsic part of the movie.
Well, I mean, it's a post-Glasnost story, in that it's, you know, in the 90s and sort of the early 2000s, you had a few of these films. I mean, The Peacemaker also comes to mind, the George Clooney, Nicole Kidman movie, where, you know, you have these movies set in a post-Glasnost Soviet Russia, where the bad guy is somebody that wants to return things to the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, basically what's going on now. But, okay, all kidding aside, but I mean, that it was a way to still keep a Russian bad guy, which is a staple of a lot of 70s, 80s international action and spy thriller films.
Absolutely.
But do so in a way that allowed you to film in Red Square. I mean, you could film in Red Square because, hey, it's not modern Russia that's the bad guy. It's the person that wants to take modern Russia backwards.
Yeah. And you have that shorthand of the Soviet enemy that you can work with to keep people, oh, well, okay, I know who the bad guy is here.
Exactly. And so, you know, and if any, I mean, and it's not, in some ways, it's not necessarily just a 90s, early 2000s things. I mean, the Bourne films, as they move along, we find out that one of the main villains throughout the entire thing is a Russian oligarch who is controlling the oil fields. So it's essentially the same, you know, an element of the same kind of plot.
It's following the same. Yeah.
I mean, it's not this, but you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like they were, oh, you know, we know, we can say, oh yeah, because we know that, you know, oil industriates are bad, and, you know, oligarchs, they're bad, and mobsters, they're bad. Let's make him a Russian who does all of these things.
Yeah.
And so in this case,
it's Ivan Tretiak. Yeah. Ivan Tretiak, who's, like you said, an oligarch in Russia. And his goal is to get a formula for cold fusion from an American scientist named Dr. Emma Russell, who is played by Elizabeth Shue here. And Tretiak is aided in his effort to try to get this formula by his greasy son, Ilya, who might be the worst of the 90s men from this from this era. I mean, his love of German bass music and his coke habit and his terrible hair, everything about him is just awful.
And yet he's also just he's a famous dancer and choreographer who has done just some stunning work on that level.
Totally different people then.
Yeah, right? It's...
So he's a really good actor then.
He is. I actually, you know, I think he does a fine job in the movie because he is so oily and so horrible that he doesn't actually need any plot development or character development because you just know he's horrible from the
From the moment you see him, he is the villain in this film. Yeah, there's really? He does nothing and he's the bad guy.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll get to it, but I think one of the hints that you get Valerie Nikolaev, mm-hmm. I think one of the hints that you get that Nikolaev is a much better actor than this movie allows him to be, is there's this scene about a third of the way through where, you know, they're haggling over whether or not the saint is going to work for them, and Kilmer is pretending to be somebody else. And I love that Ilya Tretiak through the whole thing is like, no, that's the guy. That's totally the guy. Yes. And I mean, and when he finds out that, yes, he was right, that he was actually the guy,
yep.
The excitement, I mean, he is so happy with himself. And it's really the only time in the entire movie that you see Ilya have like this burst of emotion. And it's like, oh, you actually are a person. You're a human being. You can get excited at something.
Yeah, you have motivation here.
You're thrilled with yourself because you saw through the disguise.
Yeah, I mean, the whole goal here at some point is that the Tretiaks want to hire Simon Templar to steal a piece of information for him. And so that makes it interesting. You don't see a lot of films where the hero is a thief for hire versus somebody working for some sort of secret organization or mm-hmm. a government organization. And I don't know if they did enough with that in this film, that gray area, that, you know, shifting morals, that, you know, that he could do basically whatever he needed to. And they instantly said, like, no, this is a good person, even though he does not do always good things, but he is motivated by good for the most part in this film.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's where this becomes an origin story, right? I mean, mm-hmm. because the saint, as we know him going forward and how we know him in the George Sanders and the Roger Moore and all of the pre and then the books and then the previous incarnations is he's a quote good thief. Mm-hmm. In that he is essentially a Robin Hood thief, in that he is going to rob from those who deserve to be robbed from and give it back to those who deserve to have it. Yep. And here we are dealing with, you know, again, this goes back to his tragic backstory that doesn't mm-hmm. quite work, but,
no.
You know, he is so disillusioned from how he was raised and who he was that he just needs to get his $50 million and retire and go away.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something I find very unusual about this film, is that the origin story is also supposed to be his last job ever, because he is looking to get $50 million and then he's done, he's out, which is such a weird number for, like, you know, $50 million and I'm done. And that's the whole motivation in this film, is just to make $50 million. Like, there's nothing he's going to do with that money. We never establish that that's going to allow him to do something or live a certain lifestyle or buy something or get somewhere. It's just, I want $50 million and then I'm done.
Well, and that's, again, it goes back to the vagueness of his character, because we're not supposed to know anything about him really yet. And it's all, this is in some ways, this is the birth of franchise filmmaking. Mm. This is in some ways what I've learned to call, in the wake of the Lord of the Rings films, and the Twilight films, the prequels to sequels that we will never see. And what I mean by that is that in some ways the saint is an early incarnation of this sort of idea in Hollywood, that you take something that is potentially popular, maybe it might have been popular ages ago, it might be, you know, it might be popular in literary form, whatever it is, there is the potential to have it go on forever, like a Harry Potter or like, you know, the Lord of the Rings, or like a James Bond, or like the MCU, which is at the moment the holy grail of this whole madness. And what what studios, not so much the filmmakers, but what the studios sort of ordain is that you have to, you can't tell a complete story.
Yeah.
You have to instead put little, you know, snippets and allusions and hints at everything that is to come. And you have to leave so much open-ended that you can't actually close the story that you're actually trying to tell. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is nobody then wants to watch your movie because you haven't given them a complete story.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And The Saint doesn't quite fall into that problem because it does actually tell a complete story.
Yeah, it has a beginning, middle, and end, but
exactly. Yeah. And you do have a fairly good grasp of who this character is at the end, and you know what he is going to be going forward. Mm-hmm. But you can see the beginnings of that, that mentality sort of seeping in, and that, you know, you have Paramount sitting there going, oh, we just made all this money with Mission Impossible. Let's try to do that again with this.
With Batman.
And with Batman as the star, and we'll hold back stuff. We'll hold it back. Mm-hmm. And we won't put it into this movie because we'll be able to put it in future movies. Well, guess what? You aren't able to put it in future movies because this movie wasn't successful enough for you to make anymore.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because there is a lot to like about this film, especially because it is such an excuse for Val Kilmer to bust out costumes and accents like you wouldn't believe. I mean, that's really the draw of this film, is to watch him just lose himself. Often just kind of put a layer on top of himself of something interesting, like his Aussie accent or his creepy old guy, which is amazing in my opinion. That's one of my favorites, is his creepy old guy that he does. What is your favorite character that he creates in this film?
You know, I love the Aussie from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty great. His Austin Pendleton riff that you're bringing up, you know, that is fairly funny. You know, so when this movie came out, I was sort of struggling through college at that point, and I was dealing with a lot of personal issues, a lot of identity issues, and his effete German at the coffee shop.
My favorite.
I gotta say, I mean, I was just like aghast.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I also loved it. Yes. And I was like, so that might just, and especially watching it now with everything that I've gone through in my life the past two decades, that might be my favorite character, just because I could see so much of, you know, my own journey just in the snippets, some early snippets of that character. And it's just like, okay. But I think it's just, what I love about that performance is that it's not, there's nothing campy about what he's doing
there. No, he's a character.
There's nothing hateful about, you know, he's not making fun of this person.
Nope.
Which makes him all the more lovable. And so, yeah, that's probably my favorite one, just because he does it so well. I will say, he does do a pretty darn good Rade Servadad. Oh man, I promised myself I wasn't going to screw up his name. He does do a really good Ivan Tretiak, I got to say.
That was really good, yes.
He did a nice job there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn between the German, which is my favorite part of the film altogether. especially when he pretends to go talk to his boss. Which just lady sitting in the airport is just so great. It's just, that's the casual comedy of Val Kilmer that we didn't get enough of in his career.
No.
We needed so much more of that, but it's between that and his Spanish Dracula when he gets off the airplane. It's just like, I wanted him to be play Dracula. Apparently I never knew it, but I apparently always wanted him to play Dracula because it's so fun to watch him do that part.
Well, and there is a Spanish version of Dracula. He could have, you know, we could just remake that and he could have done it.
It might be problematic now. Well, yeah. I will say the one I don't get the most is his African artist. And that one just bothers me.
Well, I mean, I get it. And it's fine-ish. It's a little strange, especially in 1997 where you're dealing with, you know, the end of apartheid, and he's South African, and he wants to take her home to his home in Africa. Like, okay, well, this is getting a little cringy. I'm not necessarily on board with all of this right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I find that as the African character that he is, his seduction of Emma is my least favorite part of this film.
Oh, it's because the thing that works. It works the worst. You are right.
It feels so very icky.
Yeah.
Because he knows so much about her by having gone into her home, mm-hmm. and used all this information against her to get to be, you know, to become who she would want. I mean, I think, you know, like, there's got to be a term for this, and I don't know that term apparently, because I was trying to think of it. There's like this element of Cyrano to it, of tricking the girl into thinking she likes a fake you, and that was huge in like the 80s. A lot of films, sure, did that.
Well, that, but, was like, I mean, that goes back to the 30s. There are so many films that are about men duplicitously. I can't talk at all tonight. I'm so sorry.
Hey, it's okay.
you know, finagling their way into a woman's heart.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, even though that they have betrayed her in every way imaginable, they forgive him.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic, and you know, of this, just from the 80s, is Tootsie.
Mm.
You know, Dustin Hoffman has no business ending up with Jessica. And I love Tootsie is one of the great films of all time. It is, mm-hmm. phenomenal, and it still holds up. And everything that it talks about and does in that movie about gender and masculinity and so many other things are so far ahead of their time, and people don't give it the credit it deserves for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way in hell that Jessica Lange would go out on a date with Dustin Hoffman at the end of that movie.
Yeah,
and they wouldn't even be friends.
You deceived me so hard and then used that against me.
Right.
Like, and that's what creeps me about. It's almost like it's like a pre-internet cyber stalking that he's doing.
Oh, totally.
And like, is there a term for that? Like, I was thinking like gaslighting, but that's not what this is. It's like stealing their confidence and then using it. There's gotta be a term for that. I gotta find that. Somebody has a term for that, and I'll have to find it, but it's not in my head right now. But that whole sequence, which is a very long sequence in this film.
Oh, sure. What's fascinating about the sequence in the film is that Simon Templar actually realizes what he's doing.
Yes.
Yeah, he realizes how horrible what he's doing is to Emma.
Yeah.
And he tries to not do it, but he still goes the extra mile with her.
Yeah, I mean, there's that entire sequence after the restaurant where he cuts himself with a bottle to make himself even more like, what's the term I'm looking for? It's just like less threatening to her, so that she'll take him in and use some sort of Florence Nightingale kind of like attraction to want to take care of him. It's so horrifying when you watch this happen in front of you. You're like, no, stop that. Especially when it's Elizabeth Shue, who is the idealistic innocent that is being, you know, targeted here. I mean, she was perfect in this role, in my opinion. Perfect choice for that role.
Well, but here's, you know, it's in some ways, it's very similar to True Lies. The only reason that the relationship between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis works in True Lies, because what Arnold's character does to her throughout the first third of that movie,
mm-hmm.
is unforgivable. It's horrible. It's absolutely the most disgusting, abhorrent thing that you can imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, at a certain point, he is literally pretending to be a voyeur watching his own wife strip for him.
Yeah.
Forcing her to do it under, mm-hmm. threat of going to prison. The only reason it works is because it's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah.
Jamie Lee Curtis is so perfect in that movie that you forget how heinous all of this is. Elizabeth Shue is almost the same in this movie. I don't think the writing of the character is as sharp as it is in True Lies.
She doesn't get to do a whole lot in this film.
Yeah, but Shue is such a lovely and endearing and multifaceted actress that she somehow makes you able to watch this stuff without wanting to throw things at the screen.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's because of her. It has nothing to do with the writing. It has nothing to do with the stuff that's happening, because the stuff that's happening is horrible.
Yeah.
It was in 1997. It's horrible. It's even more horrible now.
Yeah. I mean,
but somehow she makes it work.
could it be more on the nose, the fact that this girl even has a damaged heart? like everything about her is like, oh my God, why? Leave her alone. And I mean, I in that way, I kind of understand that Simon Templar would turn around for her. You know, like, I believe that she would have that effect on him, at least in this first situation where he does steal the formula, but then takes away part of it so that it won't go to the guy, he won't be able to do what he needs to do. Although I'm not sure what he thought was going to be the end result of that.
Right.
You're dealing with a head of a criminal organization. He's just going to go do it himself if you don't do it.
We were earlier when we were talking about films that were hits during this time period, we were arguing a little bit, not really arguing, but discussing a little bit about Leslie Dixon. Mm-hmm. Good God, she should have done a rewrite, just an uncredited rewrite of just Dr. Emma Russell, just that character. The woman that made Rene Russo's character work so well in Thomas Crown Affair, she could have done wonders for this.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Or anybody, I mean, just bring in anybody, because as much as I do like both Strick and Hensley, wow, is this character just like some bizarro land male fantasy of what a wounded good girl, super intelligent, super sexy, unrealized female archetype is supposed to be.
Yeah, she's almost the opposite of a manic pixie dream girl.
Oh,
she is like the polar opposite, and it's like, you know, you just the girl that you want to take care of.
Yeah, it's someone needed to come in and look at everybody and go, can we just, you know, do a little bit more here?
Just a little character for her, please.
Please. But again, I mean, it's a testament to Elizabeth Shue. It really is that she makes all of this palatable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think she makes it almost work, but just that she makes it palatable is really something extraordinary.
Yeah, it says a lot about her talent.
It totally does.
You know, once he gives the partial to Tretiak, the partial recipe for cold fusion, Emma actually traps him again now, because she, and then like, wow, so she has some skills of her own to, some charms and some smarts here, and then gets him turned over to Tretiak, which leads to this elaborate escape attempt, which takes up a lot of the film. Like, there's a large percentage of this middle piece of the film is him trying to escape from Tretiak.
Which is Philip Noyce at his best.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the crazy stuff that happens in the film, including, like, Emma drops her pills that she needs for her heart into a river, and Simon risks hypothermia to get him. So we're, like, really building up this, thief with a heart of gold here. And eventually a streetwalker, if we're going to do the heart of gold thing, a streetwalker then helps hide Simon and Templar from Ilya and his goons. But I'm like, why? How is it that Ilya can find him so easily? Like, they're, like, running around Moscow, and he's always right behind them. I don't understand how this works.
Well, they're bloodhounds. I mean, Russians are part Siberian bloodhound, right?
I mean, there's a scene where he's standing in the street and looking at a bunch of buildings and immediately goes, that's the one. Out of all these buildings, and there's no clue, there's no hint, nothing. He's just like, that's the one, and they zero in right on him, which leads then, Simon and Emma to join forces with Frankie, who is an underground art dealer.
Who deserves her own better movie.
Certainly.
What is with this character who just pops out of nowhere and saves everything?
Where did Frankie come from?
Yes.
I rewound. I was like, wait, what? Did I fall asleep during this film? Because suddenly there's an entire underground world in Moscow involving a character named Frankie that never was introduced or mentioned or anything in the rest of the film.
And then she shows up again at a pivotal moment to, like, to help engineer the climax. I mean, she is the coolest character with absolutely no context whatsoever. And, like, what is up with this woman?
She's the definition of Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting there thinking the writers were sitting there going, oh, we are written into a corner. We need something.
Yeah.
Just throw Frankie in there.
Well, Frankie will save him. Frankie will give him what he needs.
No one will question Frankie.
No. Well, and who would? I mean, I don't think I've seen this actress, Arina Apeksimova. I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else. And I'm like, You're awesome. Yeah. I want to see more of you.
Exactly.
What has happened?
And I think that's where, unfortunately, as we point out several times, is that the Saint doesn't know what to do with these female characters. And like, they just throw them in there and then forget that they could be characters.
Oh.
Well, Simon gets Emma close to the U.S. Embassy because she has to escape the country in order to, you know, protect this cold fusion thing. This is a scene where I was like, wait a second, what? Hold on. So she has to run a good distance. I would say maybe a quarter of a mile, maybe a little less than that.
Probably less than that.
To make it through the gate to safety. She is, however, being chased by Ilya, who is physically fit enough to fight Simon and basically beat him. She has a heart condition.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, people with heart conditions play professional basketball.
I get it, but she's on medication for her heart condition.
We have not exactly seen her working out throughout the entire film either. No. So, I mean, I get it.
She beats Ilya in a full-out sprint and then realizes she hasn't needed a pill. Are we to believe that Simon, as a saint, healed her?
It's very possible.
Because, I mean... That's
I just like that she gets to the American embassy and they just let her in when she screams, "I'm an American," and they just let her in.
The security's pretty low.
I have to say, that's probably my favorite bit is that I'm an American. Okay, we'll just open the door. Here you go.
And nobody chases her.
And nobody else tries to get in. Yeah. And I mean, because there's like this crowd out there that's all trying to get visas.
Yeah.
And
I'm pretty sure that's not protocol.
It's like, wow, this is definitely a pre-9/11 movie.
Oh, absolutely. I'm an American.
I'm an American. Okay, yeah, sure. Just come on in.
Now, I was a little surprised at this point because there's a lot still to go in this film. And I was like, are we almost done?
But you know what I kind of do love about that chase is that it does in some ways subvert convention in that, you know, in most thrillers like this, she would have been caught and Simon would have had to go save her.
Yeah.
And that is not what happened. She actually does get away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting twist on a very standard, you know, thriller women in peril convention. And I did like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't do wrong by Emma for sure. I mean,
not at that moment.
They didn't help her build up a character, but they also didn't treat her as a damsel in distress.
Exactly. So
that's a helpful thing.
Yeah.
However, at this point, the plot goes a little haywire because
just a little bit.
Now we find out that it's no longer about Tretiak trying to get the cold fusion. Now he's trying to have a coup on the government and tricking the leader into paying for this cold fusion technology, which he believes doesn't work.
Well, but he's been always trying to do a coup. Right? Yeah. At the very least, he's been trying to get it so that he could, you know,
do power. Yeah.
Or at least have the Russian version of a recall and have the people put him into power.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of kind of twists into a coup, but that's always been his design. I mean,
now it's more of an economic thing.
Yeah. And the thing to remember throughout the whole film is that Tretiak is the one that has engineered this crisis. He is the one that has been holding back all of the fuel and all of the oil secretly.
Yes.
Forcing everybody to go all Dr. Zhivago and, like, you know, use the random, you know, wooden fence next to their house as, you know, firewood.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice touch. It was like, look, we're having a little bit of, we're getting a very unusual callback here, but okay.
So since Tretiak thinks that the cold fusion doesn't work, Simon decides to change things around and give Tretiak's physicist the complete formula so that he can work now. So then when Tretiak begins his coup and tries to demonstrate that this doesn't work and it's going to make the government look terrible, the machine lights up the night sky. Now, Sarah, are you an expert on cold fusion?
No.
Okay. Do you know when it works?
Nobody knows when it works or when it doesn't work.
Why is the entire crowd so excited about this blue light?
Because they were told it worked.
This is ridiculous.
I think we have, you know, if nothing else, this past year has taught us that people will believe anything if you tell them loud enough.
I guess, but they get so excited about this blue light that they decide not to overthrow the government, which is going to happen in that spot at that moment.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, because the blue light is freedom. It is going to give them all, it's going to bring peace to the world, and it's going to warm their homes, even though that there's like no way that that could actually warm their home in this moment, because you still need decades of how to actually use it to power anything.
How do you capture this energy?
Yeah, but hey, look, it worked. So the guy, so our Russian leader was not lying to us.
Maybe they're big fans of Kmart in Moscow and just they love a blue light special.
But I mean, at least here it was just a nice blue. Hey, you know, it's the precursor to the blue light into the sky that we see in every superhero movie.
This is true.
but I mean, at least here it was just a blue light. You know, in Chain Reaction, they actually blow everything up.
Chain Reaction,
which is essentially the same plot. Think about it. It's also about,
how dare you bring up Chain Reaction on my show?
I'm just saying they are what, 1 year apart, and they both revolve around the same red herring.
It's very much the Dante's Inferno, Dante's Peak Inferno of Cold Fusion volcano films.
Yeah. Hey, no Dante's Peak slander. I love Dante's Peak.
No, it's nothing against it. It's just funny how often two films will come out with the exact same storyline.
Oh, all the time.
Well, we got our blue light and we have our happily ever after, obviously, because everything is good because of a blue light. And and then we get creepy old man Kilmer again, who's there for Emma's big speech, which I'm there all every day, all day. Bring me more old man Kilmer. I'm all for it. I love it. And then Ilya and Ivan get arrested because,
why not?
There's no proof or anything of any of this, but hey, why not?
But the proof of them holding back all of the oil comes out.
Oh, eventually, yes, because of the hacking that's done. Yeah. And a part of that is that major nonprofit donations were made out of Trejet's riches to a whole bunch of charities, which is so hackers. I love it. Like,
it's also, again, it's the birth of Simon Templar as an actual saint.
Yeah, a Robin Hood. Yeah, as you said before, you know, giving to the poor from the rich.
Exactly. And that's what he does now going forward.
Even though we've never seen that he has that skill, but hey. Why not? I would have liked for him to have like a team of some sort of network that he worked with. Every good hero, in which he is technically a hero, needs some sort of support system, because he has a ton of really interesting tech in this film, very James Bondy.
Uses himself.
Like, how does he not have a support system? Like, I don't know if you saw Black Widow.
Oh, of course I did. Yeah.
But that character in Black Widow that works with Black Widow.
The Q that just came out of nowhere that we've never seen in any other MCU movie ever?
Exactly. I felt so bad that we're never going to see him again because it's a prequel. But
we might, who knows? We got the Hawkeye. He could show up in the Hawkeye television series
Let's hope, because I really enjoyed him. And that's the kind of character I thought the Saint needed, somebody to help him out and work with him.
Well, I mean, if you're trying to make this into a Mission Impossible spinoff, that seems to be something that they would probably have done going forward.
But you need to tip that. You need, like you said, they didn't give enough of it to create the full story. And they didn't tip that he has like a network or team or support staff or anything like that.
But and also at the same time, the Saint, as different, again, and we've gone over this, but I mean, as different as this is from the source material and from the previous incarnations, in the source material, in the previous incarnations, the Saint does not exactly have a support staff.
This is true.
He is his own Robin Hood and Friar Tuck and, you know, Little John all in one.
No, I just don't know how believable that would be in the long run.
It would totally not be believable, especially for a franchise like this. And one that is moving into a technological age that this one already hints at.
Yeah. So we should talk about the fact that there wasn't a different version of this film with an alternate ending.
Yeah.
Because in that film, Dr. Russell dies about two-thirds of the way into the film. Trechak Jr., you know, like Ilya, he stabs stabs Emma and kills her.
That was probably and this is interesting because, you know, as a critic, we all like to rail on test audiences, but this is probably one instance where the test audience was correct in that would have been a bad idea. Now that said, it would have connected better to the opening.
No, this is absolutely true. You lost another one that he was trying to protect.
Yeah. And then, you know, then that you could see how losing the second one could easily transform him into the type of hero that she wanted him to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she has been inspiring him to be, and then having her die and all that. I mean, you could see how it could work.
Yeah.
But I mean, just from an enjoyment standpoint, and from there's no way that that would have been a good idea. I mean, the movie already ended up not being, I mean, it wasn't a bomb.
No.
People forget that. It just wasn't successful enough to spawn the series that the studio wanted.
Yeah. It was the Mummy, essentially.
Yeah.
Where they tried to make the Dark Universe and it didn't work because nobody wanted to. Exactly. To see the Dark Universe.
This is thankfully a better movie than that, but had you killed her off 2/3 of the way through, this movie would have bombed. It would have opened on January 2nd and it would have died within a week.
Oh, certainly. You need her in there to balance this film out.
Yes, correct.
Do you have anything else you wanted to talk about with this film? Anything that we didn't talk about?
Oh, you know, I think we've had such a good time with this one. You know, it's like you talk about this movie and it's really easy, as I think anybody listening to us go into this in exhausting detail, I think it's really easy for people to assume that The Saint is a bad movie because there's so much about it that just doesn't quite connect and doesn't quite work and doesn't fit together. And I think what I want people to understand is that's not true.
No.
It is actually a very entertaining film.
There's a lot to like about it.
It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And there are pieces of it that don't fit together. And there are elements where you wish that it was doing more.
Yeah. I wonder if a good editor could have knocked this down and made it a tighter and more interesting film.
Well, this movie had a good editor, though. I mean,
yeah. Well, a good editor separated from the studio, I should say.
We're not talking about Terry Rawlings is not exactly a...
Yeah, but I'm saying separated from the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the film could have been separated from the studio influences, and if there wouldn't, and if Noyce and Kilmer could have been on more of the same page, certainly I think things would have maybe worked out a little bit differently. This is a fun film to watch. It's a fun film, even in its flaws, in its mistakes. Those mistakes, they make you excited to talk about them.
Yeah.
You can't help but smile and giggle and chortle and have a good time, even when you go over its flaws. And I guess that's what I want people to understand about this movie. This isn't one of Kilmer's films where you're like, oh, I can't believe he was in that.
No.
It's
never boring. There's always something happening. There's some great performances in it.
Yes.
It doesn't come together as the franchise starter that they wanted it to be.
And again, Noyce does direct a couple of signature Philip Noyce suspense sequences that really are terrific. I mean, we were railing a little bit on how long that chase sequence goes on in the middle of the film, but it's really well done.
Yeah,
and
there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and I mean, and I love that. That is one thing on the Philip Noyce commentary track where he does go into some of the things that they had to change and do differently on the day that they were shooting to just amp up suspense. I mean, like the trip down the pipes and everything. Yep. I mean, and how they tricked that out and how they did it. It's fascinating and it's thrilling when you watch it. This is the guy that directed Patriot Games and Dead Calm and Clear and Present Danger. And there are moments when you notice that.
Oh, yeah.
But it could it have been a better movie? Should it have been a better movie? Does it have tons of flaws? Is it a misfire? Yes, but it's still worth watching.
Yeah. It's not a boring misfire, which is the worst sin, in my opinion, if you have a boring misfire.
Totally agree.
Well, we have had our say, so let's hear from the man himself.
It's time for a reading from the Book of Val.
So our reading today comes from Val Kilmer's memoir, I'm Your Huckleberry. There's a very short chapter devoted to the Saints. But as with the chapter on the Ghost in the Darkness from that episode, half of this section focuses on Cindy Crawford, who was his girlfriend at the time. That said, he did share these thoughts about the Saints. My bid for an ever-blooming franchise fruit was basically what you might call a Tom and Jerry film. I put James Bond, Ethan Hunt, Jason Bourne, Jack Ryan, and the rest of this category. The cat tries to catch the uncatchable mouse. All else is window dressing. The Saint had lots of window dressing. It was great fun, and in some ways opened up the window for the Mission Impossible franchise, nailed by Tom Cruise with impassioned athleticism. In The Saint, I spoke in a variety of accents, wore a variety of disguises, pulled off a variety of stunts, not as well, I might add, as Cruise or Damon, but I gave it my all. Thanks be to Val. I mean, you know, he understands where this film stands in the canon, and but I think he definitely, you know, put his effort into this film. It was not a phone-in film.
I agree, and I think his comments are pretty much spot on. I think that's a perfect way to sum up this movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I've found the most. That people view in doing the series, people view Val Kilmer as an artiste and, like, you know, maybe an egotist, and but I find more often than not, he's got a really great sense of humor and has a good view of himself, that he understands where he stands in amongst things.
Well, I know it's open in some theaters today, and I think it hits Amazon Prime either next week or the week after. Mm-hmm. Anybody listening to this podcast, anybody listening to this series, they are going to want to watch Val.
It was fantastic.
It's fantastic. It's absolutely stunning.
I mean, heartbreaking, but unbelievably good.
Right there with you. It's one of the best. It's going to probably be one of my favorite documentaries of the year.
Yes, when we get down to it. I would agree. And just a stunning, you know, the fact that he has all this footage from across his career is incredible.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, just the things, like, did you stay for the post-credit sequence?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. No, I've watched the whole thing.
I'm like, yeah, oh my God. The footage he has. And, like, I hope when they release, if they release it on physical media, that they put some cut stuff that they didn't put in the film, because God, I want to see more footage of what he shot when he was just doing his films.
We can hope. Who knows? With Amazon Prime right now, it's in Amazon Studios. It's impossible to tell.
Pretty much.
Between them and Netflix.
Although it is A24, so A24 can be pretty
good. That is true.
Well, we've heard what he has to say, so let's hear from some other people.
Come, children. Let's explore the Kills and Valleys.
Kills and Valleys are the best and worst reviews of this film. On Rotten Tomatoes, The Saint earned a rather low 30% from critics. You know, not great praise across the board. Magnolia Dargis of LA Weekly, she said, The Saint works. The reason why it occasionally soars is Kilmer, an actor who's happiest when he's burying himself in eccentric characterizations, a trick he performs repeatedly here, even as he fills the screen with pure movie star dazzle. So she really liked it. That's surprising.
No, she gave it probably when I was going through and looking at some of the reviews from the time, she's the one that really seemed to enjoy the movie the most, where, you know, Janet Maslin and Roger Ebert were kind of like,
Yeah. As you said, Roger Ebert, so writing for the Chicago Sun-Times, said, compared with the sensational stunts and special effects of the Bond series, The Saint seems positively leisurely. The fight scenes go on for too long and are not interesting. The villains aren't single-minded enough, and The Saint seems more like a disguise fetishist than a formidable international operative. I mean, I can't argue with the fact that he does a lot of disguises. That's definitely his thing.
Here's the thing I will say, though, about, you know, it's like going and looking at some of these reviews, and I think Ebert's review of this movie is really, it's fun to read, and it's a really good review. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with almost any of it, but I think it's a really, really good review. But here's the thing that I noticed going and looking, reading Ebert's and Janet Maslin's and some of the other ones. There's one, I think, in the San Francisco Examiner from Barbara Schulgasser that I really disagreed with. But one thing I noticed looking at these is that, for me, I try, when I review a film, and I'm not always successful, I'm not going to say I'm even remotely perfect, because I'm not. Mm-hmm. But I try on a certain level to review the film that I'm watching and the film as it is, and not spend a lot of time on the film that I wanted it to be. Because those are two different things. And I will say, what I noticed in going and looking at some of these, you know, these mixed, or, you know, mixed negative, or even just the flat out negative reviews, is that a lot of them weren't so much mad at the film itself. They were mad because the film wasn't what they wanted it to be. And those are two different things.
Yeah.
And so that is something I wish people would remember when they're looking at something like The Saint. It is not a James Bond movie.
No.
And it's not really meant to be a James Bond movie.
Yeah.
And if you are looking at it as the way Ebert puts it, you know, a formidable international operative. He's not an international operative.
He's a thief.
He's a thief who is just tried to steal stuff from people. So of course he's good at disguises.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe if this thing had become as popular as the, you know, Fast and the Furious franchise, he would go from, you know, being a thief who steals DVD players to, you know, suddenly driving a Pontiac Fiero into outer space.
There you go.
That could have happened. It's possible. It who knows? But that's not what this first movie is. And no. So that is my only thing I will take away when you're looking back at some of these reviews, is that a lot of them are looking at the film against Mission Impossible, against a James Bond, when that's not what this is.
Yeah. I mean, and as you mentioned that, I'll read one from Owen Gleiberman, who was writing for Entertainment Weekly at the time. And again, it's where he compares it to another film. Top heavy with whimsy, so muddled it makes Mission Impossible look like a model of narrative cohesion. The Saint is the apotheosis of the new incoherence, with the cliches of espionage and action thrillers jammed together like bumper cars. I don't see that. Like, I don't see that in this film.
I don't either. I don't agree with any of that. I mean, I can look at some of the other negative reviews and find stuff that I agree with. I just took it differently. I don't agree with just about any word of that at all.
Yeah. So over on Amazon, the unwashed masses have left us 1,346 reviews as of this recording. And of those reviews, 78% were 5-star. So people will like this film. So
well, there you go.
Here's some reviews. I think I've seen this a billion zillion times. I love it that much. I guess the idea of dressing up and being different people, trying to figure out this or that, being a spy. I love Val Kilmer and Elizabeth Shue. So, so good. Trying to think of who else was in this flick. there's a special kind of person who leaves reviews in Amazon.
They are. There are definitely. I completely agree.
I purchased this film for my spouse. She is in love with The Saint. Figure she can take a break from having to look at me so she can enjoy some Val Kilmer eye candy. Plus, it's Elizabeth Shue. You can't go wrong. Oh, we get a peek into their painful marriage that's going on.
That's when was that review left? Are they still together? Are we betting on that?
I have come to appreciate movies like this more and more. No Academy Awards, which is a bonus to me now, and has action, drama, humor, romance, and heart. Also, no social justice warrior BS. I love picking up gems like this on Amazon. Movies out of Hollywood now are complete trash.
Did they actually watch the movie?
Somebody who goes against capitalism and
there's helps, elements
helps
about
the nonprofits and
climate change and female empowerment and but you know what? Yes, there's nothing in this that would have any political social justice connotation.
We'll see what they want to see.
Okay, yeah, I'm just gonna wow.
Yeah, well, just 3% of the reviews on Amazon were 1-star, so you know, most people were pretty happy. Here's a couple that were not happy. Here's the thing: when this movie came out in 1997, Kilmer's good looks and all the disguises he put on might have been enough to propel this story, but watching it today, a lot of it comes off as very cheesy. Many of the characters he creates just seem ridiculous, like a smooth talking African.
Yeah, actually, they're not wrong. It's not worth 1-star. I mean, that's not a 1-star review.
No.
But nothing they said there is necessarily incorrect.
Was this supposed to be a comedy? Kilmer's acting was laughable, but not in a humorous way. This film was so bad that I fell asleep multiple times while watching it late morning after a good night's sleep.
Okay. Wow, that's harsh.
I mean, that's, you know, I have no issue with Kilmer's acting in this film. He's having a lot of fun.
He is. It is. And we both went over that. I think Kilmer's great in this, and I think he's having a blast, and it's the loosest and that he had, it's probably one of his loosest performances in the 90s. Yeah. And it's a definite callback to his work in stuff like Real Genius and Top Secret.
Certainly. And then the last one, sex undertones were lame, which I don't even understand. So,
okay. I don't know if I would use lame. I mean, they are, as we went into, they are the creepiest aspect of the film.
Certainly.
And they're the element of the movie that kind of makes, I think, both of us kind of stand back and go, yeah, maybe that's not going to be.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, there's some cringy there, but lame is not where I would go. I mean,
no, not at all.
Yeah, no.
Well, we have a decision to make.
With or without Val.
So does Val Kilmer make or break this film? Now, before we answer that question, I just want to mention who turned down the role of Simon Templar before Val Kilmer became that role, became the star.
Mm-hmm.
Mel Gibson, Sir Kenneth Branagh, George Clooney, Kevin Costner, Johnny Depp, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. They all turned down this role. So...
That's like, you know, that's like saying that Sylvester Stallone was originally supposed to play Axel Foley.
It's quite a range there.
Yeah, it's like, wow. Okay. Yeah.
So what we left with is Val Kilmer. So do you think Val Kilmer makes or breaks this film?
I think Val Kilmer is the reason to watch this film. I think I think he makes this film. And I mean, of the people that you mentioned, there's very few there that would make me think that this would have been a better film with them in it. The one that would have been the most interesting to me of the people that you mentioned might have been Daniel Day-Lewis, because Daniel Day-Lewis can actually do comedy, and he can do this. There was a period in time where he could do this kind of role. Yeah. And I think that would have been fascinating to see an actor of that caliber, but it would have definitely been more of a Roger Moore type of saint.
Yeah. Kenneth Branagh, he would have been an interesting Simon Templar, but a different Simon Templar.
Yeah. And And I mean, and Branagh has done other films where he's taken on characters similar to this. So, I can see where he would just not be interested. He probably also would have wanted to direct it, which the studio at that time probably would have not wanted, only because Dead Again, unfortunately, did not do as well for Paramount as they were hoping at the time.
No.
Although, and now it's like a classic, which it should be, because it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, we're going to play a game now. It's called Know Your Saints.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to do horrible at this. Okay.
So in The Saint, Simon Templar took on the identities of a variety of Catholic saints during his adventures. And many of those saints were patron saints. So these are, for those who don't know, patron saints are supposedly, they watch over different types of people, situations, and so forth. So Sarah, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a patron saint and their specialty. Uh-huh. And you're going to tell me if it's a real recognized saint or a faux patron. So for instance, if I said that St. Anthony is the patron saint of lost things, the answer would be true. He is the patron saint of lost things.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Okay.
So here's the first one. St. Balthazar is the patron saint of playing card manufacturers. Is that true or false?
Oh, that's horrible. I'm that's just so bizarre and so weird. I'm gonna actually say yes. Probably have something to do with card tricks, who knows?
And you would be correct. Saint Balthazar is the patron saint of playing card manufacturers.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay.
So number two, Saint Columbus. Saint Columbus is the patron saint of motorcycle riders.
What? There's a patron saint of motorcycles? Seriously?
Patron saint of motorcycle riders, Saint Columbus.
I'm gonna go no, but why not? No, I'm gonna go no. I'm gonna go no.
You would be incorrect. There is a patron saint of motorcycle riders, and it is Saint Columbus.
Well, now I have to look that up. I don't believe you.
All of these are true. Number three. Well, no, I shouldn't say they're all true. I say they're all real.
Well, now I know. Now I know the secret here. I'll just say yes to all of them.
Patron saint of bloggers, Saint Ecriture.
There's a patron saint of bloggers?
Saint Ecriture. Is that a true patron saint or a faux patron saint?
No, I'm going to say no. There's no way.
And you would be correct. That is a fake patron saint.
All right.
Here's the next one. Saint Drogo is the patron saint of ugly people.
real. Wow. Oh, well, okay. Well, that's got to be true.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
You would be correct. San Diego is, in fact, the patron saint of ugly people.
Wow. It's got to be French.
Next one. St. Bronzatora.
Oh, come on. Is he French? I need to know.
I don't know. I didn't look up the Latin versions, unfortunately. I'll have to look that up later.
No, I need to look that one up, too.
St. Bronzatora is the patron saint of sunbathers.
Oh, wait. Isn't there a saint of, like, for dermatologists?
Maybe.
Oh my God. I think I actually know this. I'm going to say no, because I think there's like a Saint Bartholomew or something. That's like the patron saint for dermatologists or dermatology or skin. Well, so I'm going to go no, because for some warped, weird reason, I think I actually know this.
Well, trusting your instincts work, because you're correct. There is no patron saint of sunbathers.
Thank God.
Next one is Saint Garand, who is the patron saint of kombucha.
What?
Saint Garand, the patron saint of kombucha.
Sure. Why not?
Unfortunately, that is wrong. There is no patron saint of kombucha, although based on the rest of this list, who knew?
Right? Yeah. I mean, it seems like there should be a...
Well, here's the next one.
There should be.
Saint Gomarus, who is the patron saint of difficult marriages. I think they were involved before with the video on Amazon.
What did you say their name was?
Saint Gomarus, the patron saint of difficult marriages.
I'm gonna go no, because it feels like that should be another French person if it is true.
Sorry, it is true. Saint Gomarus is the patron saint of difficult marriages.
Oh man, I feel terrible now.
How about Saint Tolkig, who is the patron saint of furniture?
Oh, okay, sure. I mean, why not? There is a picture of a saint at IKEA, so I'm going to say that's probably them.
Well, you did mention IKEA, but there is no patron saint of furniture. However, Tolkig is the term for a end table at IKEA. So that is not correct. There is no patron saint of furniture.
Oh, I don't believe you on that one.
I made it up.
I want to know who the person is at IKEA now. I'm going to look that up.
Next one is Saint Vetist, who is the patron saint of children who learn to walk late.
Children who what?
Saint Vetist is the patron saint of children who learn to walk late.
Well, that's just so obnoxious and bizarre that there's no way you came up with that. So that's got to be true.
I wish I had the imagination to come up with that. It is true.
Well, there's no way you came up with that one. Sorry.
You are currently at 5-4. You're leading, and you have one last answer here. So you can win or retire. You're not going to lose. Okay. So that's awesome.
Last one is
Saint Devarius, who is the patron saint of amusement parks.
Well, there has to be a patron saint of amusement parks. I'm gonna say no.
And you would be correct.
Yay!
There is no patron saint of amusement parks. So you win 6-4 in Know Your Saints. Congratulations, Sarah.
Well, that's awesome. I have to look up. I still don't believe you on this furniture thing. I have to look that up.
Well, that's it for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd like to thank you, Sarah, for joining me to chat about this little exercise in disguise. I had a lot of fun. I hope you did too.
I did. I had a blast. Thank you so much for asking me, and I'm glad that we got a chance to do this.
Me too. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Again, I'm going to plug my my current 1001 Great Film series that's currently going on at the Seattle Gay News, sgn.org, with reprints at the end of every month over at moviefreak.com. We are currently halfway through the series. We're 500 films in, with another 501 to go. And the next outing, I mean, the next installment will be not this coming Friday, but the following Friday at SGN.org.
You have all 1001 plotted out at this point?
It took so much time. So I was basically dared to do it. And then once I did it, I realized I needed to do something with it. It was like, I spent all of this work coming up with the list that I had to do something with it. And I pitched it to an editor at the paper and they were like, we love this idea. And I was like, well, how about I write like one or two little feature pieces? And they're like, how about you write 10? And I was like, well, sure, why not? Without ever realizing what actually writing 10 features would entail, yeah, and how personal I would have to get. And what's interesting is that, and it's been pointed out to me by a number of people, the series is basically, it's a combination of cinema 101, and it's also journey through 100 years of cinema with Sarah. So you get to learn about more about me as a person and where I've come from than you probably do about the movies I'm talking about. Which is very frightening and freaky, and I'm still not sure how I feel about that because I'm not normally a personal writer. So that's been different.
Well, it's quite the undertaking, and I hope people appreciate the amount of effort that goes into this.
I will say I have changed. Yeah, one of the things I stress throughout the series is that a list like this is ephemeral. It's a living, breathing thing, mm-hmm. and it's never set in stone.
Mm.
And what I started with back in January is not the same list that happens now.
Mm.
That there, I have made replacements as we've gone through. And that's how it should be, because
Absolutely. You
know, what you love and what is dearest to you will change at any given time.
Yeah, it's so reflective of who you are at the time.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for doing that, because it's really just an amazing effort and just a lot of fun to read.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So in our next episode, we'll be heading over to Get Biblical with the Prince of Egypt. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter @kilmercast. For myself and my guest, Sarah Fetters, thank you for listening, and remember to keep it Kilmer.